May I speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer. Amen. The Gospel, according to John, proceeds in its first chapter at a breathless pace. The writer, whom we know as John the Evangelist, is not John the beloved disciple, but clearly is someone who probably knew the beloved disciple and who certainly stands in the line of the beloved disciple's teaching, which the Gospel of John preserves as this very distinct tradition of teaching, quite independent of the apostolic tradition in the synoptics. And we feel the pace of the narrative. At the 29th verse, we read, "The next day, Jesus appears before John for baptism." And then at verse 35, "The next day, Andrew, one of the men who witnessed the baptism, followed Jesus and introduced his brother Simon to Jesus." And at verse 43, again, "The next day, Philip enters the picture and follows Jesus." And Philip finds Nathanael and announces the joy of his discovery. "We have found him about whom Moses wrote, Jesus from Nazareth." To which Philip, ever the wit, replies, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Day one, day two, day three, a symbolic sequence for John, who from the outset wants us to be aware of how his story ends, Jesus' final 3 days. And John's schema is captured by T.S. Eliot. "The end is where we start from. Every phrase, every sentence is an end and a beginning." And so chapter 2 opens with, "On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited." We catch our breath as we've been propelled through the first chapter, moved from the majestic opening of the prologue, words conjuring up images worthy of any Star Trek movie, and finding ourselves on the planet's surface, so to speak, watching God's only Son coming and going among the local inhabitants, calling this one and then these ones, before arriving at the most domestic of all scenes, a small town wedding where there seems to be a problem with the wine. The first part of John's Gospel is known as the Book of Signs. John proceeds to build his narrative around 7 signs, each designed to demonstrate and to confirm Jesus' divine origin and purpose. John's sign stories certainly contain inexplicable miraculous happenings, but to get into a debate about whether miracles or supernatural events happen or not is to miss John's point. Signs always have the function of pointing beyond themselves to something that is greater. We're in the season after the Epiphany, and John intends to draw our attention to a rolling sequence of epiphanies. Remember a Greek word meaning showing. And these epiphanies reveal to the disciples the inner truth about Jesus' divine identity and his purpose, truth accessible only through the medium of faith. The wedding at Cana of Galilee is a favorite of many, many weddings, and it's noted in the preamble in the Book of Common Prayer, the preamble to the wedding service itself, that Jesus was present at a wedding event, valuing the lifelong marriage of people as a reflection of the love that is clearly shared within the divine community. The story has some interesting features. We're told that Mary, who in John's Gospel is only ever referred to as the mother of Jesus, she seems to be the principal guest, named first, with Jesus lumped in with the disciples in second place. And we're left to wonder why the bride and the groom appear nowhere in the story. After all, it's their wedding. Their wedding is simply a convenient backdrop for the focus of action between Jesus and his mother and Jesus and the minor servants. And when Mary tells Jesus that the wine has run out, he responds, "Woman, what concern is that to you or me?" And addressing his mother as woman seems abrupt and dismissive to our ears. Yet we need to note, however, that his use of the address woman, sounding to us like the all too familiar patriarchal put down of women, is also the way he addresses Mary when she is standing at the foot of the cross and he entrusts her to the care of John, the beloved disciple. "Woman, behold your son." And here, woman communicates respect and the agonies of love and loss. Having seemed to dismiss his mother's concern about the wine, her response is in the vein of, "Whatever, Jesus." And she dismisses his tone of rather priggish self-importance and remaining confident that he will do the right thing. She says to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." And having appeared to dismiss his mother's implicit request, Jesus nevertheless does as she obviously intended him to do, like all good Jewish sons. And Christian commentators have often read in this story, with its reference to the contents of the large stone jars for the water of Jewish purification, they've read into this story a meaning that is not necessarily supported here. The traditional interpretation has seen Jesus in turning the water for purification into wine as an abrogation of the law of Moses. But perhaps a better interpretation here is that the water hitherto reserved for ritual purification, which is a process of a kind of exclusion, now becomes the wine of inclusion and welcome for all. Now, who's the audience witnessing this first sign? Well, there's Mary and the disciples and the minor servants, although they are incidental to the story. No one else at the wedding has any inkling about what is happening, which causes the chief steward to exclaim to the groom, "You've broken with common sense and custom and served the best wine last, after everyone is well on their way to being drunk. Now, down the centuries, the more Puritan in the Christian community have felt perplexed that John should report a wedding event as the first sign of the kingdom. After all, a wedding where the main thrust in the narrative is around the quantity and quality of the wine seems somewhat trivial, if not unworthy of the image of the coming of the kingdom. Others, however, have welcomed and been affirmed by John presenting Jesus at a wedding as the setting for the first of his seven signs. It's reassuring that Jesus seems to have enjoyed parties and that occasions of joy and merriment involving eating and drinking and general conviviality say a great deal about the nature of God's kingdom. A place of abundance in the form of good things, food and wine and companionship and even drunken bonhomie, all symbolizing the goodness of God's creation. And the story of the wedding at Cana is unique to John. It occurs nowhere else in the New Testament writings. There's no overlap here with the synoptic tradition. Nevertheless, my question this morning is, how do we hear this story with our 21st century ears? Well, in the short term, it occurs to me that we receive this story speaking to us in a place of need. Into the third year of the global pandemic, amidst the heedless headlong rush towards a looming ecological catastrophe, we have a need to see God's invitation to faith as an invitation to the celebration of social joys. More important now, after 3 years of the on and off quarantine that has left us not simply yearning for the return of our previous enjoyment of social life, but more worryingly, has now instilled in us a reticence, a wariness of social situations that may not so easily dissipate with the end of the COVID emergency. The wedding at Cana of Galilee reminds us of the essential nature of social celebration, something not only essential to our human nature, to our human sense of well-being, but also a central manifestation of God's intention for the whole of creation. And over the longer view, we hear the first of John's signs of the kingdom with 21st century ears as being reminded of the importance of seeing the world through the lens of faith. For many of us, this is a tall and even risky ask. Whether Andrew, Simon, Philip, or Nathaniel had a greater imaginative acceptance of the miraculous than we do, or maybe not, we're not privy to their first century mindset. What we do know is that they were changed as they witnessed in Jesus the quiet and unseen way divine action in the world comes about. Like them, we are hungry to be changed. And yet, we remain fearful of change. This is a balancing act, and what will it require to tip the scales firmly in the direction of our yearning to be changed? The disciples' hunger led them to begin to trust Jesus enough to follow him And now he rewards them with the first of the signs. They will go on to experience seven signs. Yet the first one is enough to completely rewire their whole world view. You see, it's all to do with the way you see things, the lens through which you view the world. What we call reality is not real. Reality is only the particular way we see things through a particular lens. And the lens through which most of us view the world at the moment is a lens that equips us to see some things, normally the bad things, while missing others, usually the good things. Chief among them, the quiet and unseen ways divine action comes into the world. To break open the dead shell of yesterdays and to equip us to do what we came here for, to waste our hearts on fear no more. Food for thought, no? Amen.